On Thursday, November 24th, we hear from you in the last open mic of 2022. What's driving the new immigration targets? What is a carbon budget? Closer to home, how can we reduce the amount of salt used in the winter? Get an update from the Guelph Hiking Trail Club. Finally, what does Guelph's new council look like?
Good morning to everyone. I hope everyone is well rested and looking forward to getting their Christmas shopping done locally. Once again, we have a breezy breakfast hour, and today we have a buffet of questions, comments, and concerns related to the future of the city. But before we get there, I'm going to do the territorial acknowledgement, and I'm actually going to read an explanation of the statement, as that's perhaps as important, or perhaps more important, especially as the city works to revise its territorial acknowledgement at this point. As we gather, we are reminded that Guelph is situated on treaty land that is steeped in rich Indigenous history and home to many First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people today. As a city, we have responsibility for the stewardship of the land on which we live and work. Today, we acknowledge the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation of the Anishinaabeg people on whose traditional territory we are meeting. Now, the explanation of statement is fairly important. The first sentence of the territorial acknowledgement provides the context that the history does not start at the point of European contact. Rather, it begins long before and includes the Anishinaabe, Attawandaran, Haudenosaunee, and Métis peoples, and continues to the present day. Second sentence refers to the role and the responsibility of the city as a present-day steward of our public lands and natural resources. Finally, the third sentence recognizes that today the people of Guelph reside between the Lakes Treaty No. 3 territory, which is signed between the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation and the Crown in 1792. And what I did learn is that many of the lands around us have never been ceded by treaty. And this is something that to this day is quite controversial and potentially challenging. I often wonder whether First Nations Indigenous claims will have an impact on some of the more questionable legislation that the province is putting forward that relates to conservation areas, wetlands, and rivers. And I have to say that I do hope that Indigenous rights do have an impact on those bills. I think that this could be the only thing that can potentially protect green spaces and wetlands from development at this point. But that said, before we get going, I'm going to ask Morgan to please outline her thoughts about something that the city is offering, known as setting the table. So over to you, Morgan.
Thanks so much, Phil. I had the great pleasure of being able to gather with approximately 100 community members at Waverly Drive Public School last night. The day or the evening started off with a little bit of excitement, as it was very much interwoven with Indigenous practice. While the sage ceremony was happening, we had the pleasure of the fire alarm going off. So we got to see the Guelph Fire Department and stand outside for a little while they cleared the building from the smoke from smudging. So it was an interesting start. We had an incredible meal that was provided by Yassi of Community Food, and it was put on by Our Food Future. The group is the Food System Resiliency Table. They do have a charter. It has 6 points. It's still being worked on right now. What is happening that is so incredibly exciting is that they have $20,000 that they're going to be giving away to community members and organizations so we can build connection and well-being in our community. So what it says on this little card is, setting the table, gatherings on food equity and community resilience, is a series of events co-created by community members to build community connection and well-being. Being in communities with each other is important. Communities provide the supports and resources we need to live healthy and happy lives. So basically, if you send an email to nfw at wd www.cgpublichealth.ca, you can ask them how to go about applying for this. The applications are for between $200 and $1,500. And it's for whatever kind of event you would like to put on in order to create a better sense of community for you in your area. So some of the suggestions that they gave as examples, if you live in an area where there is a community skating rink and you would like to create a little bit of an event where you're giving away hot chocolate to everybody that comes out and you want to create some advertising, you want to print some flyers, you can apply to the fund to get maybe $300. So you can print the flyers, get the hot chocolate and the marshmallows, and go and have a great event by your skating rink. Or if you want to do it in the summertime, you can do it at soccer, baseball, even football, maybe cricket, any of those kinds of things. Or if you wanted to put together an event where young people could learn some traditional cooking from older people, bring in just any idea that you have. And that's why I wanted to bring it up today, because applications have to be in to the group by the 31st of December. The funds will be awarded on the 16th of January. You can fill out the application by going to 10C and asking to find out about more about the Setting the Table Community Fund. Let's get this $10 million that was granted to the city and the county for our circular food economy working even harder. I heard last night that the $10 million that we were granted has been leveraged to bring another $15 million into the city and county. So the more we can leverage this money that we got from the federal government to create more food resiliency and a better connected food community, I can't think of anything better. So for the people listening on radio, the email to send if you would like to become part of the food system resiliency table is ashley.cooper@guelph.ca. That's ashley.cooper@guelph.ca.
Thank you, Morgan. I think this is indeed something that should be pursued by people if they are engaged within a community group, whether they be church groups, community groups, whether they're neighborhood groups. It sounds to me like this is a good opportunity for using food to power initiatives and ideas within the community that perhaps we might all embrace. The truth is that food, conversation, and progressive movement of a community have always gone hand in hand, and kudos to the roundtable and to Setting the Table for presenting this. I'm looking forward to hearing from some of you on initiatives that you're working on. I see John Fisher is with us, and yesterday he spoke to my Rotary Club about trails, something that is near and dear to John's heart, and I'm hoping that he can provide us with some information on the Guelph trails, perhaps a little later on, and opportunities for people who might be looking for something to do as they go for a walk, aka trail cleanup. But I will deal with that later. As everybody is aware, Canada was in the World Cup in the slave state of Qatar the other day. Canada did very, very well relative to what it has done in the past, and made a good show of the capacity of Canada to grow in World Cup football. And that was yesterday. And we're not going to talk about that, but I wanted to crow about it despite the loss. I thought, well, Canada's looking really good. There are, however, a number of issues that I think that we can review. The library, hospital hopes, the South End Rec Center, Guelph's groundwater concerns. Perhaps we should deal with the strong mayor. Perhaps we should even look council composition and who comes from where and what can we expect from and the perennial concern that people have, housing and homelessness in Guelph. I'm going to try to stay away from the elephant in the room as much as I can, because that elephant is coming to Breezy Breakfast next week, and that is Bill 23 and Bill 109. However, I do know that this will percolate through, because both those bills and the Strong Mayors Act will have a significant impact on the work of the city and the work of municipalities in Ontario for some time to come. We can't avoid that. We should not avoid the discussion. And I am certainly hopeful that we will have some tangential, thoughtful comments that are made about this, but reserving the meat of this for when David Douglas and others are speaking to us next week on these issues. With that expertise, we will certainly fare better. So having said that, I have some advanced questions in the chat, and I am just going to try to read these, or Tanya, would you prefer to do that?
Sure. I will share my lovely radio voice with all of you. So I believe it was Gordon who made a comment in advance, and he said, I would like to see a comprehensive plan that supports and provides the rationale for welcoming large numbers of immigrants and the intended effects on the well-being of people and societies on both sides of the movement of people. All levels of government should be engaged in creating a long-term vision. And I believe that's a good point to make, because as a province, well, so the federal level dictates how many people come into the country. The provinces then have to decide where's everyone going to live. And then in Ontario decides where are these people going to live and how quickly are we going to build homes. So it would be nice if all levels of government were to work together.
In thinking about the immigration thing, it gets very complex very quickly. And unless you have some larger framework, you don't know whether you're just trying to increase GDP, maintain the status quo by getting cheap labor. What are the objectives here? What are we trying to do? And what's the long-term impact? Are we going to continue to increase our consumption, bring in people from low standard of living areas who all aspire to have our standard of living, and continue to increase the amount that we exceed the boundaries of the earth to support. There's a lot of stuff at play all at the same time, and I don't see anybody tackling that in a way that creates a framework that we can all understand.
Thank you, Gordon. I'm going to go to Kevin. He's got his hand up.
I'm not an expert by any means, but my understanding is that the primary purpose of Canada's immigration policies is to address the fact that Canadians, the people who currently live here, aren't having enough kids. And so our population is increasingly getting to be large amounts of older people who are not working and, but still need to have a place to live and still need medical services and all that sort of thing. And there's not a big enough tax base of young people to sustain that. And so you have to bring in people from other countries to have those people get jobs, and then you tax them, and you can use those tax revenues to fund the OAC and like old age pension and CPP and medical services and all that sort of thing that our aging population requires.
I think Kevin raised a couple of really important points there. And I think that we do need to extend the immigration policy, the practical elements of immigration a little more broadly. It is indeed true that immigration policy does focus on the bringing in of people to offset the nuclear family and the problem of the nuclear family. This is a part of the standard economic equation that we must continue to expand our economy into the future if we wish to continue to sustain a standard of living that is similar to what we have now. That's just a fact of economics. It's a constant expansion of the industrial and the economic base that must occur. So when we're looking at things like the Canada Pension Plan and old age security, the question must become, in order for those to remain viable, who pays for it in the future? And so we do bring immigrants into Canada for that purpose. The other thing that we do, and there's a bit of a tension in this one, we bring immigrants into Canada because we refuse to pay for training and education of skilled workers. The irony here is that we don't necessarily bring into Canada people who are trained and who are skilled and use their skills. The best examples of these are people in professional areas such as medicine and education or law, where people will be required to go through enormous hoops in order to become qualified. I'll give you a good example of that. If a person were to be educated in a Cuban medical facility, despite the fact Cuba has one of the best healthcare systems and best training systems in the world, they cannot be certified in Canada without undergoing some fairly rigorous tests. And I have no problem with the tests, but we have a quota on the number of medical professionals that we will permit to work in Canada. On the other hand, what we also need to recognize is that new Canadians, and I'll use the phrase new Canadians just as a broad frame, oftentimes are not used for their skills. They're used as unskilled laborers, and they provide, in some senses, an underclass in the economy as well. The best example and observation that I can make on this was during the election, when I was in the Willow Road area, and I was struck at how significantly the demographics in the Willow Road area had changed from 4 years prior. There's a whole new population base that exists in that area. New languages, new cultures, and I like that. I'm in favor of that. But you cannot get away from the fact that it is, in many respects, an impoverished underclass that is living in an area that has limited facilities and does not provide for a positive quality of life. That policy causes us issues both at the provincial and at the municipal level. And one of the issues that we're dealing with right now and is being dealt with in a ham-fisted way is, where are these people going to live? And while you might live in an apartment for the early part of your time in Canada, generally people are looking to move out. The Bhutanese community in the Willow Road area moved into the Willow Road area from Mississauga. There were only about 150 of them. And within 4 years, they virtually moved out of there as well as they spread. Those people look for better areas in which to live. And so Doug Ford has come up with the More Homes Act in order to accommodate people who are looking for homes. Problem is, and I would argue, that's, I'm gonna stay away as much as I can, Tanya, from next week. Better homes and more homes really isn't what any of those pieces of legislation are about. They're about more power and better opportunities to use power. Maybe that's the way they should have been framed. So the reality is that immigration in Guelph and immigration elsewhere provides us with many, many challenges. It's heartwarming that we live in a community where we have a very, very broad diaspora of people that are enriching Canada and enriching Guelph. Right now, the Islamic community in Guelph is the largest growing community that we have, and is growing by leaps and bounds. And I feel that I profit very much from having new Canadians in here and extending my knowledge and my appreciation of different views, different visions, different cultures that offers. But having said that, Morgan, you wanted to make a comment.
Yeah, just when you were talking about especially doctors, one of the other aspects of having internationally trained doctors, and it's not only immigrants, because I used to work with a Canadian-born doctor that wasn't able to afford medical school in Canada. So went to medical school down in the Caribbean. And so now he's an internationally trained doctor. And the process for him to be able to become a fully licensed doctor in Ontario, the biggest problem is getting a supervising doctor. There's not enough doctors in existence that are willing to take on the burden of being a supervising doctor in order to get internationally trained doctors certified in Ontario. So that's another piece of the puzzle that we've got to figure out somehow.
So what you are saying is that our whole structure for training and educating doctors needs a revision. That until such time as we can actually establish a healthy healthcare sector, we are limiting our capacity to benefit from people from throughout the world. And that's an interesting question. The fun facts about hospitals today, which I did not realize, is that many hospitals that are beyond capacity actually do have the capacity. What they don't have is the workforce. And so beds are going empty in many hospitals as well. That to me was very shocking. I didn't know that until yesterday. And that causes me to reconsider much of what we are hearing in the media. We've got a much, much bigger problem. And I would suggest that we need to review the Canada Health Act, review training, review how we address shortages in the medical field. But it's not just the medical field. If we truly do wish to welcome people, we need to acknowledge that there are a lot of skills out there in everything from education to legal to medical to research that should be embraced. And we should take down many of the impediments and the barriers that stop people from benefiting from what they were trained in, arguably sometimes for years. Tanya, I believe you have another question as well.
Indeed. Okay, this is with regards to climate action. An Edmonton city councillor is trying to get the city to adopt a carbon budget where every line item, such as a road widening project, would have to account for its impact on the carbon budget. For example, it's similar to our situation in Guelph with tenders for road and bridge projects coming in at 50% over the dollar cost, and we have to decide what we can do because we can't afford it. Oslo, Norway is way ahead on this with their similar climate budget. And so Mark Darman from GCAT asks, should Guelph be adopting a carbon budget for real climate action on our interim and 2050 climate targets?
Good question, Mike. Before I begin, is there anybody that wishes to chirp in with what they believe is important? Should we be embracing the notion that we need, for all intents and purposes, a green element within our budget? We already look at the bottom line from the perspective of whether something is economically viable, socially viable, and whether it's good for the economy. But this is more important in some senses, perhaps. Do we need to actually cost out carbon? And I will look to anybody who wishes to offer their views on this.
We need all the data. If we're not measuring everything, how do we know we're capturing where our costs are going? And that's one of the things that got me so excited about Donut Economics, because I knew nothing about economics before I started reading it. Our economy excludes everything that we need to extract and all of the waste that we create. That's not captured in how our economy functions. So if we're not finding those externalities of how the economy functions that have major impacts on the reality of our funding, then how are we knowing whether we're doing what we say we're doing?
I hear you, Morgan, with regards to, yeah, we need data. But data is never fully in. So I think at some point we have to assign numbers to various projects, because that's really the only way anything's going to actually get done. Otherwise, I foresee years and years of study, right? Oh, we're going to build this bridge. How many emissions are going to come from this concrete, blah, blah, you know, driving the stuff to the bridge and back. I think it would be more practical. It would be practical to assign numbers, get enough data and assign numbers, carbon numbers to projects, because the data is never fully in.
I would support that idea generally, as you put it in the general sense. I think everything should be viewed through an environmental lens. And carbon pricing is one part of that. And certainly in arriving at that, you then start to think about the impact on consumption and levels of consumption and all that kind of stuff that we really need to be paying attention to. And I submit we need to be reducing our consumption, not increasing it. That if we're working towards ultimately an average level of consumption that everybody can achieve in the world, our level of consumption far exceeds what's realistic and possible. So that's the bigger picture that we're just not dealing with. And this is a good start.
Great, thanks. Rod, I noticed that you had something in the chat.
Yeah, I don't think we can organize a carbon budget in dollar terms. It's really should be in how much emissions is considered to be acceptable. And does that form a baseline? And then if you go above that amount, then you're contributing to further degradation of the climate. So, well, how do we set up a baseline so that we can actually function with a carbon budget?
Thank you. And I'm going to see if Mike Darman, whom I believe was the originator of this question, has any comments that he wishes to make. Mike, I see that you just came on, and good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too. Actually, Ron just hit it right on the nail. What this thing I think is trying to achieve. I think we do actually know what the impact of every project we do, how much of carbon emissions it will actually impact our actual goals, actually. So that's what we have to start looking at. And if we actually budget that amount, I think you actually put a limit on it right from the start, just like you would with anything else, right? You have a budget that's got limits to it. And as I say, every project that the city would look at, by the way, I heard this program, if anybody's interested in listening to it, it's a program that's on Sunday morning. It's called What's on Earth. And I'll try and send the link to you guys, because it was super interesting to see how Oslo in Norway has actually used this. They call it a climate budget, or what they call it, climate, and as opposed to a carbon budget, but it's the same thing. They basically know what they have to do, and they have a budget for it, and everything they look at is in the lens of, this is going to cost us so much emissions, we have to stick to this plan. So that's kind of the idea. I'm not fully understanding the whole thing, but I think that's the basic idea.
Yeah. Before I comment from the city perspective, the one thing that I think is really interesting about what you said is actually the nomenclature. They refer to it as a climate budget as opposed to a carbon budget. And Mike, I'll ask you that first. Maybe there's others that want to chime in on this as well. What is the advantage of referring to it as a climate budget rather than a carbon budget?
Honestly, Phil, I don't know why they call theirs a climate budget, but it may have just been the term they used at the time. I'm not really sure. I'm sure it all had, but when you listen to they actually interviewed a person from Oslo, and it was all around emissions. So it was all around emission budget again. So it was basically the same thing that that councillor in Edmonton is trying to get Edmonton to adopt. So it sounded exactly the same thing.
What struck me about it was that I think that the word climate is both softer and it's less specific, and it's also more urgent for many people than is the word carbon. And when I heard that, I thought, Mm-hmm. I'll bet this has been done deliberately because it's more consumable, pardon, no pun intended there. And in a place like Edmonton, I'm surprised they're using the word carbon. When I lived in Edmonton, carbon was king, and I think still is out there. So perhaps the councillor is doing it to confront the fact that the Alberta economy is very much dependent on carbon, whether it's from the oil sands or whether it's from coal fields. I don't know about that, but I think that you're waving a red flag in the faces of Albertans and Edmontonians as soon as you do that. And I'm not certain that's not such a bad idea out there as well. From the perspective of the city, I think that it would, honestly, I'm not trying to delay, but because we've now engaged in a 4-year budget cycle, I think actually this is a perfect time for us to push forward the notion of a carbon or a climate budget. And I like the idea quite a bit, but it would be something that I would suggest would be prepared for the next full budget cycle coming up in complement with the next term of council. That gives 4 years to prepare for this. And budgets, because they are fairly complex and we're dealing in wealth with $500 million, it would probably be more palatable to look at it that way. And having said that, I can argue that the city and virtually every organization in Canada, probably in the world, does do a carbon budget right now, but we don't refer to it as that. We refer to a carbon or a climate budget as what are the costs of putting in place the safeguards, anything from a catalytic converter to insulation in a building, which is part of our carbon budget. We never mention it like that. Regrettably, what we do say is it's going to cost us money to save energy. And so it's a negative thing as opposed to a positive thing. Climate strikes me as something positive. We're dealing with something for the future.
I've always taken an interest in the GJR. And I see in their annual report a fair amount of greenwashing related to climate, saving trucks from traveling across Guelph. And I never see the other side of that, basically, which is, well, what are the opportunities for not having a railway line going all the way through Guelph, but turning it over to a trailway for non-vehicular vehicles, for bicycles, for pedestrians, for goodness knows what else. What's the other side? So I think we just got to be cautious about how people use this data as well. So. I'm just throwing that out there.
And I think ultimately, so get ready, this is going to be a great segue for you. I noticed that Ron Easthead also mentioned in the chat that there is that capacity for greenwashing. And that's something that I think that we do need to recognize. Greenwashing is all around us. I drive an electric car, but there's a fair bit of greenwashing in driving an electric car. And let's be honest, it might be better than a gas guzzler, but it's not perfect. And I can't pretend that it's not. And as much as the oil industry comes with significant human rights issues, so do electric vehicles as well. So the point about greenwashing certainly needs to be expanded. Kevin, you talked about both. Do you want to comment on that here now?
Yeah, sure. I think the Guelph Junction Railway potentially could be a huge boon to the city, because like Kitchener, our neighbors, they recently built that Ion light rail transit, and it was a very expensive project for them, but I'm sure it'll work it out in the end. It's a vastly superior to bus rapid transit or having people drive around in personal vehicles. Guelph already has a rail line, a couple rail lines running through the city, and that's the most expensive part of infrastructure for light rail. So, I mean, if Guelph wanted to do light rail, the job is already partially done, and the most expensive part of it is already done, sort of. So yeah, maybe not, you know, next year, but in the near future, I think it would be a huge opportunity that the city could put some light rail transit on the GJR. And there's no reason they couldn't put parallel trailways in there for like a multi-use path.
Thank you. Yeah, appreciate that. Sorry, Kevin, didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Nope, that was it. I was done.
Good enough. I noticed that I missed Karen Rothwell because I don't follow the chat very well. Karen, you wanted to pipe in as well. Let's hear from you, please.
When I saw it was open mic, I thought, okay, this is my moment. And my topic's not as meaty as Canada's immigration or carbon, collecting carbon data, but I wanted to talk about something a lot more local. And it's exceedingly important because we live in a groundwater city. And I've noticed after that first snowstorm we had about 10 days ago, 2 weeks ago, there was an enormous amount of salt that was winter salt that was spread across the thresholds of a few establishments downtown, and in particular RBC, BMO, and CIBC. And nowhere else, the city did not go nuts. The city, you know, always does a good job when they're making sure things are safe, but not outrageous. But if any of you are downtown, take a walk just in that little area down there. And it's not right. We cannot afford to pour enormous amounts, copious amounts of salt on every threshold. We live in a groundwater city. We have to be more careful. This is something we can personally and locally do something about. And I've written some letters and I sent a letter to the editor, but I'm hoping other people won't just walk by it. At the rally up in Fergus last week for Bill 23, Mike Nagy was there and he said something and it's reverberated ever since. He said, I just can't let this one sit back and let this one go by. And of course, none of us can watch Bill 23 go by, but I can't walk across that salt carpet and not speak up. And I'm hoping there's a few other people on this call that maybe do go downtown and we'll have a look. It's not fair that certain people feel that they can just salt our watershed, our creeks. Every bit of that salt goes into our rivers and our creeks, and it goes downstream to our neighbors. I know they're worried about getting sued, and I appreciate that, but we have to do something else. Maybe the individual has to step up a little more too to protect themselves when they're out walking around on a winter day. We cannot salt the entire environment in case one person may slip. We have to use our heads. So I know you can't legislate common sense. I've heard that before on this program, but I'm hoping that there will be a few people with common sense that will speak up, because under the influence, CIBC, I heard somebody else referring to CIBC this or CBC News this morning. And I understand on Under the Influence with Terry O'Reilly that it only takes a few people to actually make a comment or write a letter and things will change. And just so you know, I did not sit back on this one. And I'm hoping there's a few other people in Guelph that will speak up. I know our city's doing a good job, but we need everybody's help with this. We can't salt over our children's future.
Thank you, Karen. Before I get to Morgan, I just want to unpack a couple of things that you've made mention of. So this is private firms that are overly salting, not the city. Is that correct?
Right.
I just want to clarify right. That.
They're proper winter property managers, right? And they've said, whoa, yeah, we've had trouble here before. Make sure we're really salty. We don't want any more lawsuits. Right. And it's not everywhere. You'll see when you walk.
Yes. And in your letters, which I certainly appreciate, I'm picking your brains here and I don't know the answer to this. Karen, were you providing any alternatives to heavy salting, any other de-icing techniques? I'm just curious.
My alternative to heavy salting is reasonable salting. You don't need to pour a carpet. I'm not in exaggeration here, Phil.
Yeah.
It's a carpet salt.
Yeah, no, and I get that. Yeah.
It doesn't work like that. You don't need all that salt. Some people believe the more salt you use, the safer you'll be. And it's just not true. So that's number one. Number two, of course, sand mixed with salt can help. It's messy and mucky. You got to clean it up, but at least we're cleaning it up inside our stores. We're not cleaning it out of our rivers and creeks it's impossible. I'm saying individuals need to take more responsibility if they're out walking. I'm not thinking we're going to change these litigation for a slip and fall suits anytime soon, and maybe that needs to be revisited. But people could wear thick coats so they don't break their hip when they fall, or wear mitts and a thick hat so you don't hurt your head, or a helmet if you're shaky. Bring a cane, a walker, or a walking stick. Anything we can do. I'll just a short segue to a story. In 2000, I had the good fortune of visiting San Jose in Costa Rica. My sister lives there. We were walking down a main street on a sidewalk. There was a huge pothole in that street. There was a little cone sitting in it, an orange cone, but a huge pothole. A child could have fit into it. And I was aghast. I asked my sister, how could a city have a big pothole in their sidewalk like this? You know, won't they get sued? She said, Karen, the city expects everyone to watch out for themselves. You walk into that hole, that's your stupidity. And so maybe we need to do a little bit more about that. I don't want to see people in the hospital, and I know nasty things can happen when people fall, but we could do more. We don't have to carpet our thresholds with salt.
Great, and thank you. Well, clearly you do know the way to San Jose. I haven't been there for a while. And I think that we do need to recognize that the only time more salt is necessary is when you're eating French fries or popcorn, and then bring on the butter as well. With regards to future questions and concerns, I'm going to go to John Fisher to talk about trails, because it was a good segue from walking safely to walking and enjoying nature. So, John, let's hear about the latest activities that you've been engaged in. But John has been engaged in trail development and trail rehabilitation, would be the best way of putting it. And I think John is looking for volunteers as well. So I was going to give you the time to make your elevator pitch.
Okay. Well, yeah, we're always looking for volunteers, especially in an executive position. Lots of people like to walk the trails, but we have the same problem of most volunteer organizations, where people are not really willing to step up and take on the executive positions, which do take a lot of effort and a lot of work. So we have a number of program kind of coordinators that we need, like for example, communications. For we were looking very hard for a trail coordinator, and the hiking trail program is like 50% of what we offer, guided hikes. And without a hike trail program coordinator, a lot of that falls by the wayside. And of course, COVID hit really badly. We lost hike leaders and so on. And we basically took 2 years before we were able to recruit somebody into that position. So he's just started. I hope it's going to be really good, and that part of the program is going to take off again. But there's always and we know that there's a couple of other positions. Officer positions that are going to become vacant. Like we're going to need a secretary, membership director, coming up very shortly. Even our finance person has given us a heads up that maybe in a year's time he wants to step down. So, but these are all kind of critical positions, and it's all volunteer. You know that that's how these organizations work. But we think we are doing good work in the city, and we think we are offering a real community service. Most of you know that we were involved in the Gosling Bridge over on the university property. You know, that was an $80,000 project. It was probably a $250,000 project in university money if they'd had to do it. We're involved right now in a bridge in Crane Park, where we're putting a community bridge there on city property. It's a $64,000 budget. We've already got about $53,000, so we're getting close. That's probably another $200,000 amount in terms of city dollars. If the city was doing this, it would cost at least $200,000, and it would also take several years to accomplish if it could ever make it onto the budget list. So anyway, so we think we do good work. We've done we've put an extension between the skate park and Imperial Road now. We've just opened a side trail there. It's a precursor to, we hope it's a precursor to a proper multi-use path. But again, it enables people to use a trail that's maintained, again, years before the city is going to have the budget or the ability to actually do that. We're very happy to give it up as soon as they say, okay, we're ready to do it. But the restrictions on what the city can do are they're big. So for us to be able to get in there and provide an interim solution is always a great thing. And then we're working behind Wellington Plaza. City is committed to do some work there to help that out. And I know that part of that is supposed to be a future park. Who knows whether that will happen? Again, if it was to become a future park, it would be zillions of dollars. And not sure that's the right decision anymore, to be quite frank with you, especially if the trailway could be made really attractive and safe and people want to use it all the way down to the covered bridge. So, so those are the kinds of things that we're doing around the city. The trails master plan was very helpful because it allowed the city to delegate organizations like ours to establish tertiary trails, recreational trails. So we have been much more active in the city. Like the other one is the Rapid Side Trail in the Dufferin community. So anyway, so that's the kind of stuff we do. We're always looking for members, although our membership has grown quite significantly. But none of this comes without some kind of cost. You have to get insurance. You have to have a website payment. You have to buy materials. You have to buy wood, nails, everything, right? Boardwalks. And our trails aren't just in Guelph. We have 84 kilometers of trails that we maintain between Limehouse, Cambridge, and the Kissing Bridge Trail. So if you notice in town now, we have just installed a couple of trailhead plaques, one in Marion's Park and one at the skate park. So we did that with the support of the city, but they're big plaques. So they're like 3 feet by two feet. They're illustrated maps, and they basically give you an indication of where our trails go from an illustrated standpoint. They're really quite nice. So that's the kind of stuff we do anyway. So any questions?
Oh, no, thank you very much, John. I do have two questions for you. And then I want to get to Susan Watson, who has a couple of points. Where is Crane Park is the first one. And would you talk just very quickly about the trestle bridge out at the Guelph Correctional Center and what the future might hold for that historic structure?
Yes, that's great. So Crane Park, if you take Stone Road and you go due west, you'll cross over the Hanlon. And if you just kept on going, there'd be a big right 90 degree turn going north. We don't take that. You just go right ahead of you. There's a little parking lot there. And that parking lot is for Crane Park. And if you kept parked your car and keep on walking down that multi-use trail, you'd end up bumping into the Speed River. And so just before you get there, about 50 yards up from that, is where the Crane Park Bridge is going right now. And the importance of that Crane Park Bridge is that it provides a link to the other side of the stormwater, which is especially valuable at this time of year when it gets to be slippery and icy and people use it. And we do hope that in the future, it's kind of a gateway to the Nisga waterfowl property whenever the GRCA ends up finishing their management plan. But it is something that should be incorporated into the city of Guelph for everybody to enjoy. And so this will be one less step that the city has to go through, because this is going to be a 25-foot by 7-foot bridge. So I got to talk to you about the trestle bridge. So the trestle bridge is the heritage wooden trestle bridge that crosses the Aramosa River right behind the Cargill plant on the site of the reformatory property. It's owned by Infrastructure Ontario. It crosses the... So it goes over to the new GID, the new Guelph Innovation District, which is now owned by Fusion Homes. The bridge is actually owned by Infrastructure Ontario. We've been working with Infrastructure Ontario for probably the better part of 18 months. A year ago, October, we actually spent nearly $25,000 with the support of donations from 100 Men Guelph helped us as well. And we contracted a firm called Wood Research Design to do a non-destructive test analysis of every structural element of that bridge. So we know exactly, and then they issued a report, and we know exactly what is good and bad about that bridge. We are in the process right now. The next step in that is to actually get an engineering study done, about $15,000, to capacitize that bridge for pedestrian and cycling infrastructure. So then we'll know exactly what the amount will be for us to actually repair and repurpose the bridge. Infrastructure Ontario is working very closely with us, but their mandate is simply to protect the Crown from any liability. They have absolutely no interest in repairing or repurposing the bridge per se. So we've looked at a number of things. We're still working with them, and we're working with Fusion as well. We just signed an agreement with Fusion for all the trails on the GID right now. So we're making the connections. We're waiting for IO right now. IO right now to get a little bit more data and to pass a report up to their through the people and what they want to do with that bridge, because we have pitched as well, why don't you just give it to us for a dollar? And the way that works from a circulation standpoint, they first of all ask the province, is there anybody interested in the province, any other departments that want it? If they say no, it then actually goes to the city. The city should be interested, but has not expressed any interest to this point. And then the third thing is it would go to parties like ourselves. And, you know, we would say, hey, we're interested. We want to repair and repurpose the bridge. And of course, if we owned it, then it makes things a lot more simple in terms of who we hire to do the job. And it would be WRD, because they're about the only people in Canada that can do this. They're exclusively wooden trestle bridge repair guys and bill guys. And there's only three wooden trestle bridges like this in the Grand River Grand River watershed area. One of them is at West Montrose. The other one is a covered bridge downtown, which is basically a facsimile of a bridge, you know, built in 1992. And there's this one. And so the opportunities that we see for the city are just huge in terms of active transportation and everything else. And of course, the planned operations campus is going on that same property, just over the river there. So there's lots of reasons why this should all come together and happen. But you know, we're not kind of waiting. We're hoping that if we keep moving it along, if you look at the Fusion publicity for selling the GID, you'll see that there's a video there that shows happy people walking across a bridge, pedestrian bridge over the river. Well, there isn't one, but this could be it. So anyway, so that's the way we're moving along. We did apply to tourist relief grant. We were unsuccessful. We've applied to the Active Transportation Network fund from the feds. We haven't heard from them. That grant had to, that funding application had to be in at the end of March. And that's why we hadn't gone after the $15,000 engineering part yet. But I'm starting to think about a plan B, and because that could have been part of that that funding. But without that funding, it seems like I need to go ahead with plan B, which is $15,000. Let's get the engineering study done. Then we'll know exactly how much we have to pay people, we have to try and get through a campaign.
Thanks very much, John. Before I go to Susan, I do encourage people to take a walk out to the to that bridge. And I also encourage you, if you haven't been there, to walk over it, if you're willing. It's a bit treacherous. It's not that treacherous. But what you will see is that there's a spectacular view of a pond on the Aramosa River that is full of wildlife. I've heard of reports of eagles being seen there and of water mammals and so on. I don't know whether beaver or otter, but it's a gorgeous place that is one of Guelph's hidden gems.
Just before you all rush out there, the IO wants to protect people from going over that bridge. They don't want people going over that bridge because of liability. So,
all right. So you didn't hear it from John and me.
Right.
If you're just going to be wild, outrageous teenagers, then you go for it.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go. Just another point. I hope that you are reading the chat. Mike made some mention of GCAT looking for volunteers as well. And I think there's a number of other interesting points in the chat that are worthwhile for people to consider. Susan.
Yes, I just wanted to follow up on what Karen said earlier, and things dropped for me in the council meeting on Tuesday. It's stuff that I fundamentally know, but don't always think about. And that's when Kathy Downer brought up her concerns. This Bill 23 is absolutely going to gut protections for wetlands. And we have already lost, like the majority of our wetlands in Ontario are already gone. And so we have this really strong protection for the existing ones that Ford is trying to gut. And so one of the key things is that currently wetlands are looked at scientifically as they should be, as part of a complex. And Bill 23 is going to get rid of complexing, so that you're only looking at it as an individual wetland, so the developer can say, oh, well, this isn't important. It's just a small wetland. It doesn't mean anything. And they're basically functionally putting the blinkers on of and so many places in this act, they're actually not allowing decision makers to look at the big picture. The other thing that I didn't fully get, like, so there's this other bizarre thing where you can get offsetting for a wetland. So you can cut down a forest or a wetland, and then you can create one somewhere else in the watershed to offset it. Like, as if that is even possible environmentally. And the thing that Kathy said is that our wetlands are an essential component of our groundwater system, because they are retaining and releasing and recharging, and they control the flow of water. And if we start messing with that, we don't even know what that is going to do to our water supply. So, you know, even if you don't feel like super, informed on this particular issue, like, please weigh in on the EBR today, even if you just say no, absolutely not, because I can tell you everything they are proposing is wrong. So just say, even if you're saying I just disagree, it's just so critically important, and it's quite astounding. And so the last thing I'm going to say is I think that municipalities should take a leaf from the unions. I think they should band together if Bill 23 passes and say that they are putting a moratorium on development, because we won't be able to afford it anymore. And I know city staff said, oh no, we'll get sued. They'll, you know, take us to the planning appeals tribunal. Well, they can't take everyone there at once. And I would wager that the costs of legal actions at the tribunal are going to be less than the money we're wasting shredding all of our plans, and less than the money that is being pickpocketed from citizens to subsidize developers. So I don't know, Collingwood was able to put a moratorium on their growth because they didn't have the capacity in their wastewater treatment plant. If Collingwood can do it, I don't know why other Ontario municipalities can just say, sorry, we don't have the money for the infrastructure to support this growth, so we're declaring a moratorium. And I think if even like 9 or 10 of the biggest municipalities did that, I think Doug Ford would be in a position of needing to rescind the legislation like he did with the notwithstanding clause. My two cents.
Thank you very much. And we get a lot of value out of 2 cents at Breezy Breakfast. Just a couple of comments. I think that Susan's point is worthwhile to consider. And I appreciate Rodrigo Galler asking the question, like, why not? I tend to agree with Susan on this. Yes, there will be repercussions and there will be backlash as a consequence of that. But I'm going to very, very quickly deal with something that is peripheral to Guelph's future concerns, but does matter. And that's the strong mayor's powers in Toronto and Ottawa. Last night, I looked at the various large cities in Toronto, and I don't consider Guelph one, despite the fact that we are known as the chair of the big mayor's conference. I don't know why they're big. I guess I've been overeating. But I was looking at, thinking about the strong mayor's powers in Toronto in particular. And it struck me that the idea that anybody could pass as a mayor legislation or bylaws with a one-third majority is clearly, I think people would agree, contrary to the principles and traditions of Westminster democracy, which requires a majority plus one. Now, what also struck me is that every council in Ontario must have within their procedural bylaw a quorum. And our quorum is 8 attending members of council. It struck me that another form of civil disobedience that the strong mayor's powers is just ripe for is to not provide quorum. Because if quorum is not at a meeting, then that minority support for something that the strong mayor wishes to do cannot be attained. It's just a thought, that there is nothing wrong with civil disobedience at all. Remember that it is civil. And that's an important element of democracy. We must always protect the rights of the minority, and we must always ensure that the majority is acting with thoughtful diligence in everything that we do. Just a thought. Let's get to a couple of other issues that are going to certainly raise their heads. First of all, I do want to just give people a quick overview of this council composition from Ward 1 to Ward 6. And if I forget any names, I apologize. In Ward 1, we have returning councillor Dan Gibson. And we also have with him a new councillor who is a disability rights advocate, I guess, or accessibility rights advocate, Aaron Caton. Aaron is, I think, a very bright, energetic person whom I hope to have on Breezy Breakfast frequently, if she will. Similarly to that, we have returning in Ward 2, Rodrigo Galler, and his new ward mate, Carly Clausen, who Carly, true, has a great background and experience in small business that I think will benefit council significantly. She's a downtown entrepreneur who has a soap shop. And if you are looking for stocking stuffers, you might want to go by her shop. And then you can stop in at the Woolwich Arms right across from her shop and have yourself a soda water and French fries. In Ward 3, I am joined by Michelle Richardson. Michelle Richardson works in the county in human resources. She is very, very familiar with legislation and systems that are, I believe, of importance to a municipal council. And I look forward to what she can contribute to that. In Ward 4, I am thrilled to say that we have Linda Busatil on council. And the reason I am thrilled is that Linda is an expert on governance, protocol, and procedure. These three areas are areas the city of Guelph has been tremendously weak upon. I've been harping on them for 8 years. I am looking forward to working with Linda so that I don't feel like I'm a voice in the wilderness and people don't feel too cowed by two things: not understanding governance or process, and also by fear that they will embarrass themselves if they continue to harp on about things that matter. Just consider this. Whether you like affordable housing or transitional housing or not, what we did about 2 months ago was we suspended our rules, you know, for all intents and purposes, and did not hear from delegates on a proposal to do matching funds for supportive housing project in Guelph. Our bylaws require that we hear from people, and we didn't do that. My fear is not nonprofits and not supportive housing and transitional housing. My fear is that a developer can say, this is a precedent. You decided to not call for delegates on a particular issue, and therefore I'm a for-profit developer. I wish to be treated on an equal footing. And I think that we are on a slippery slope there. So it's something that I'm looking forward to working with Linda upon. We also have Christine Billings returning after she's been there now, I think, about 16, 17 years. In Ward 5, we seem to have the dynamic duo of Kathy Downer and Leanne Caron are returning again, and I look forward to their expertise and knowledge and history. History being very important on Guelph City Council. We will not know where we should go if we do not know where we're coming from. Kathy carries a tremendous corporate history with her. Leanne is very familiar with heritage in Guelph. Both of those two issues, I think, are very important for ensuring the integrity of council over the future. Out in Ward 6, Councillor Dominique O'Rourke is joined by Ken Chu. Ken is 23 years of age. And Ken is doing a graduate degree at the University of Guelph while working in Brampton. Ken is very keen to learn about civic government. And because he is so young, he could be around for a while. So I would encourage all of you to make Ken your best friend, help him, make him familiar with the issues, particularly work with him on Clare Road, Clare and Maltby Road in the development out there, water issues, and issues associated with the sprawl of Guelph toward the 401, because he has some expertise in planning, he will be a great ally. These are our counselors. I hope we will have more of them at Breezy Corners in the future. Is there anyone who wishes to pipe up on anything that that I might have said there, other than Ken's age, Tanya?
Haha. I actually wanted to ask you about the results of the special council meeting.
Sorry, say it again.
I wanted to ask you about the results of the special council meeting and which councillors were involved.
Oh, you mean the last 2 days?
That is correct.
Well, we did have at one point, somebody else asked me about this as well. We had full attendance, but then apparently during the vote, we lost one counselor who did not vote. I don't know where he was, but Councillor Gibson was not there for the vote, so neither voted yes nor no. And I didn't hear an announcement from the mayor, although I could have missed it. Perhaps Mayor Guthrie did note that Councillor Gibson had left. On the other hand, what I would point out is we had incredible contributions from all councillors, and in particular, I was very keen on hearing from all but one councillor speaking on the issues in front of us. I asked my ward mate, Michelle, whether she would speak. She said no. I called her some dirty names, but she said everybody's really said what I've said. And so she didn't feel that there was anything more to speak of. But your new councillors are going to give a completely different tone to council and our working future, I believe. And my toes are crossed for, despite the adversity we're facing, I think we can do some good things with good people. Morgan.
I just wanted to mention, I was in council chambers and I was there after most people had left. One of the things that really impressed me about our new councillor, Ken Yi Chu, is he was standing, talking with Krista Waukee, getting to know her a little bit better. And from what I was able to sort of just overhear as they were having a conversation in public, was apparently they might have been working as colleagues and not recognized it. So when Ken stood up, or didn't stand up, but when Ken turned on his mic at the end and made the address to the staff and said to them, I really do know what it is that you've been going through, and I appreciate how hard you have to work. He really does, because he's been doing the job in another city. So to have that connection, and like you said, to have the connection with Carly, who is currently still running her business downtown and making so many community connections through her various markets. I really would love for everyone to keep an eye on Market, which is MKT, because that's one of the things that Carly does. She pulls together makers and creates a lot of incredible fairs. There's a bunch coming up. I think I just saw a post from her that she's got three amazing markets where she brings community members together to show their wares. So thanks for highlighting those two incredible new young people on our council.
Some of the issues we didn't cover, but I think will be covered next week when we address Bill 23 and Bill 109 with the likes of David Douglas, are water, housing, perhaps even the library and the South End Rec Center, as there could be some significant challenges to our capacity to fund these particular projects as a result of seeing our development charges being dramatically altered. Similarly, we will probably talk about taxes at that point. Now, one other thing that I would ask people to consider, I'm hoping that we can get together at Breezy Corners at some point for a couple of live events. And these would not be recorded for radio, but we would sit down just like we did in the good old days, and we would have a good old jaw at a few tables. Maybe for some time, we will have one live version of Breezy Breakfast at Rise and Shine, and one video version of Breezy Breakfast the following week, and perhaps intersperse things to give people a chance to actually meet each other again. And Tanya, I think that's my 2 cents worth. So fire away with the announcements.
Okay, well, first I'd like to hand it over to Morgan Dandy.
Thank you so much, Tanya. So last night I had the pleasure of being able to sit and speak with Councillor Caton for a little while. She informed me that December 2nd, there will be a flag raising in honor of Day of Disability at City Hall at noon, and the mayor will be on vacation at that time. So he made Councillor Caton deputy mayor, and she will be overseeing the flag raising at noon on December 2nd. I'm going to be sending that in so Tanya can put it into the formal announcements next week. It would be amazing to see as many people out to support this flag raising as possible. Thanks, Tanya.
Okay, so on to the announcements. Have your say with regards to Bill 23. There are so many EROs, there's so little time. A big deadline is today at 7 p.m. Please Google AMO consultation posting more homes built faster to get all of the deadlines with regards to Bill 23 and the opening of the Green Belt. Please go to the wellingtonwatchers.ca to protest Bill 23's effect on conservation authorities. Have your say about the downtown renewal project. Please take the survey. And remember, this project is going to be going on for several years. Have your say about water, wastewater, stormwater master plans. There's a public open house on November 29th in person at City Hall from 5:30 to 7:30. Please ask questions. Do the survey between November 30th and December 20th. Have your say about the community engagement framework and policy update. Have your say about single-use plastics. What's your take on the fees that are proposed for single-use bags and cups, and what the minimum cost of reusable grocery bags should be? You've got until January 2nd to take this survey. Next week on Breezy Breakfast, we'll be discussing Bill 23 with our MPP Mike Schreiner, with rural planner David Douglas, and with Bill McBain, a former Queen's Park insider. On December the 8th, we'll be talking about budgets. And on December the 15th, we will be talking about books. And with that, I'd say that's a wrap. Thank you very much for being here today, and we'll see you next week.
That's all for today. Thanks for tuning in to Breezy Breakfast, where the coffee is hot and the discussion is even hotter. Music is provided by Juice Jim. I'm Joe Yuyen, and I produce the Breezy Breakfast podcasts.